purport. King Pururava was greatly attached to Urvashi. Yet despite his faithfulness to her, she had left him. Now, considering that the king was wasting his rarely achieved human form of life, Urvashi frankly explained the nature of a woman. Because of her nature, a woman can respond to even a slight offense from her husband by not only leaving him, but even killing him if required. To say nothing of her husband, she can even kill her brother. That is a woman's nature. Therefore, in the material world, unless women are trained to be chaste and faithful to their husbands, there cannot be peace or prosperity in society. Om Tat Sat. Any questions or comments? Well, what do we do with this verse, dear Vaishnavas? Well, the first thing is we put our hands together like this, and we say, Srila Prabhupada, ki. Yeah. Now, if you take this verse, and you blow it up into a billboard, and you stick it on the M25, on the way to Heathrow Airport, okay? And by the side of it, you say, the beliefs of the Hare Krishna movement. Okay, these are the beliefs of the Hare Krishna movement. What does your movement believe? Well, we believe that women as a class are merciless and cunning. They cannot tolerate even a slight offense. And for their own pleasure, they can do anything irreligious. And therefore, they don't even fear killing their faithful husband or their brother. These are the beliefs of the Hare Krishna movement. Do you think we would pull in any supporters? Not really. Therefore, you can never take one-liners out of context. You can never take verses out of context. Each verse has a context. Each verse has a context in which it was spoken. Each verse has a speaker and a listener. I've just spent the weekend at Oxford. There was a Bengali Vaishnav scholars conference. I'm not a scholar. Didn't even get A-levels. But I went to a Bengali a scholar on Bengali Vaishnavism. And what scholars do, of course, is they absolutely refuse to accept anything unless they can understand the context. And what religious people do is often take verses completely out of context and make it their slogan. Very dangerous. Scholarship without understanding the meaning, dangerous. Having the feelings of religion without understanding the context, very dangerous. So we have to be intelligent and we have to be emotionally balanced in order to understand this. Hot heads cannot understand the Srimad Bhagavatam. And in fact, if you understand this verse, or if you seek to understand this verse, you have to understand the verses that come before and they understand the verses that come after. So, here I have a beautiful garland which presumably has been offered to Krishna. Okay, how did this garland become created? How did it become created? Well, if I ask a Sankhya philosopher, he will say, you have to consider three causes. At least three, minimum three causes. So you have to consider the Upadan Karana. Upadan Karana means the flowers, the material cause. The material cause is that the garland could not exist without flowers and without string. These are the material causes. Then you have to understand that there was a Nimitta Karana. Nimitta Karana means an efficient cause or an instrumental cause. It means there has to have been, when you see this, there has to have been a flower garland maker. Because flower garlands and string, even in a spiritual movement, don't assemble themselves. And then there's Samavayi Karana. Samavayi Karana means the inherent cause of something. Why is this flower blue? Why are these flowers blue? You see? Where does the blueness come from? Well, I happen to know. I don't know a great deal about flowers. But I happen to know that sometimes they put flowers in colored dyes. And within an hour, a white flower has become a blue flower. Did you know that? It's very difficult to get blue flowers otherwise. But it's more easy if you put white flowers into a blue solution, and then the flowers, you know, ingest, they suck up the blue dye. So the blue dye is the samavayi, karana, the cause of me wearing a blue flower garland. But if I look at any one of these factors independently, I'll get it wrong. If I say, you know, the cause of this is the flower garland maker, okay, no, because they're not God. Only God is karana karanam. Only God requires no original cause. So you'll see where I'm going with this in a minute. If I say, well, it's flowers and string that are the cause of this flower garland. No, it's not. Okay. If I say, well, it's the blue dye that was the cause of the blue flower garland. That's incorrect also. So we have to look at a number of factors. And when you look at a number of factors and you join them together, then you'll have a bigger picture. So, in religion, beware of taking one factor, one reason, one viewpoint, and attributing an absolute status to that. Because everything is a multitude of factors. So in this verse, in isolation, we study these verses in isolation, but actually they're not meant to be read in isolation. They're meant to be read as part of a chapter. And unless you read the whole chapter, all you'll be left with is a slogan that gets put on a billboard, either on the road to Heathrow or somewhere in your brain. And that's why we have a lot of fights between Vaishnavas, because they extract verses from the Bhagavatam, or they extract verses from Prabhupada's letters and say, look, I've got a verse where it says this. And another person says, yes, I've got a verse where it says this. That's like a person saying, I've got a bucket of blue dye. I'm going to go and make flower garlands. I've got a piece of string. I can make flower garlands now. Well, Mr. Dye Holder, no, you can't. Mr. String Holder, no, you can't. Mr. White Flower Holder, no, you can't. You see? All these factors are required. So here, we have a situation. And it's a situation which we really have to understand. Otherwise, if you try to apply these verses in the Bhagavatam to your own situation, your brain will be pickled. Why will your brain be pickled? Good morning. Why will your brain be pickled? Your brain will be pickled because you think Srimad Bhagavatam is the absolute truth. Therefore, everything in it is true. Every word in it is true. Every verse in it is true. Therefore, this is an absolute statement that women are cunning. And this is similar to women's eyebrows are like, what is it? Bows. And the looks from their eyes are like arrows. And their hearts are like razor blades. And we'll add these all up. And we'll have a, you know, kind of image building up here. But you have to read the whole book. Srimad Bhagavatam is a book of 18,000 verses. Did you know that? But if you read one verse a day, it takes you 30 years to go from one end of the book to the other. If you become a devotee in 1986 and you leave in 1990, just having read a few chapters of the Bhagavatam, you won't come away with an understanding of the Bhagavatam. Therefore, reading the entire Bhagavatam means that you'll be able to put these verses in context. Now, many of the verses, all of these verses of the Bhagavatam, were of course spoken by a man to men. Did you know that? Did you know? As far as I understand, there was no women sitting with Maharaj Parikshit, listening to Sukadeva Goswami speak. In fact, in the whole assembly, there was no women. As far as I know, there was no women sitting in the forest of Naimisharanya with Suta Goswami speaking to the sages. So you get a book that was spoken, or a conversation, series of conversations that was spoken by men to men. And when men get together, ladies, they talk about women in a particular way. So we, it's just human nature. And it's not just human nature of Kali Yuga, it's human nature at all times. And women get together, gentlemen, they talk about you lot in a particular way as well, don't you? We know. So we're not casting or projecting anything artificial on these men that were assembled. What we have to understand is that for men, men have different mechanisms by which they perform tyaga. So this is a group of tyagis. And the mechanics of the bodies of men are different from the mechanics of the bodies of women. So their tyaga is constitutionally different. So they have to be encouraged in different ways. That's why it's extremely difficult, and something we've only had to do since 1966, to give a class on the Srimad Bhagavatam to a room full of men on one side and a room full of women on the other side. Because usually Bhagavatam, apart from when you do a Bhagavat Katha or Bhagavat Sapta, is usually spoken, because it's a very high-level scripture. Otherwise, you speak Mahabharata and Ramayana. Okay? Otherwise, Bhagavatam is a very, very high scripture spoken to people who have sufficient tyaga, a sufficient distance from the nature of masculine nature and feminine nature, such that they can understand, I'm a spirit soul whose very body is acting as a detriment. When you're dealing with people who are not very advanced in spiritual life, they will look at the body of the other person as being a detriment to their spiritual life. They will project their deficiencies out onto the body of another. Well, the real problem with this, you know, ashram situation, for instance, is the women. They behave like this. Women behave like that. And the women may say, well, the difficulty here is the men. The men do this. Okay. But those who have tyag manifest, and one scholar says that, he says, when a man has lost all his fortune, then renunciation inevitably comes into his mind and heart. When a woman has lost her beauty and her reproductive capacity, then tyaga manifests in her heart. Otherwise it's difficult. Otherwise it's hard. Because the body is so powerful and so strong, it takes even the best will of the most ambitious devotee of the Lord away on a journey. And from that journey you have to pull, the intellect has to pull the concentration back. So in the beginning of spiritual life, especially when you're young, this is a book for extremely advanced spiritual practitioners. It's a book for people who were already sitting in a forest. They had already dedicated their life and hundreds of years. They were looking forward to hundreds of years of sacrifice. Just imagine that. It's a book that was a conversation spoken to a king on just 7 days before he died. The nature of the conversation just before you die is completely different. If you're with a devotee who is about to die, they don't want to look at the family photograph album. They don't want to talk about anything else. They just want to talk about Krishna. When you're by the bedside of a person who is a devotee who's about to die, who has struggled all their life to be conscious of Krishna, and in the last few days of their life, they're begging the devotees, just come do kirtan. Just tell me about Krishna. Just recite Krishna book. Who reads Krishna book on a daily basis? Any of you? Jagat Priya sort of half puts a hand up. Any of the men read Krishna book on a daily basis? Okay, not one hand goes up. Why? Are we not interested in Krishna? Srinivas, I expected you to say. Except that Krishna book is one of the five or six main books that Srila Prabhupada wrote, specifically so that we could be Krishna conscious. But we don't read it. But it's something that everybody wants to be read to them as they die. Because then, you're absolutely convinced that you're not your body. Up until that time, you're kind of convinced that you are your body. I am a man, I am a woman. And that doesn't change. Then I become a devotee. And I'm a devotee man, and I'm a devotee woman. And then we sort of create an identity for ourselves. But it's still a very material, and to a certain extent, materialistic identity. Some years ago, I had cancer, and I had an operation, and they cut through some nerves, and it wasn't healing very well. So I had a big hole right here, and I went back to the hospital, and the doctor said to me, he said, well, we have to repair this hole because it's not, it's a big hole, and I could look through, and I could see what was underneath. Take the bandage off. You know, you could see, you know, what's underneath. Anyway, he said, well, look, now I'm going to clean you up and stitch you up, but I don't want you to look. I said, why don't you want me to look? He said, because even though you can't feel me doing it, because the nerves have been cut, he said, still, your mind will think that I should be experiencing pain, and you'll project pain into the experience. Which is a strange thing. I said, no, you carry on doing it. I said, this is very interesting for me, because I have been taught many times that I'm not my body, but I've never felt that I'm not my body. But now with the nerves cut, I really feel, and it was an incredible experience. I was just looking at someone stitching up my, you know, it was like open heart surgery, except it wasn't here, it was there. But I was looking at it and feeling absolutely detached. Just like I was, I don't do this, but just like I was, if I was, to be looking at a piece of roadkill, you know, some squirrel, or when you come into Bhaktivedanta Manor, some baby rabbit that's been knocked over and squashed by a person, desperate to get to Mangalarti on time so they can't even look at the road to see if rabbits are crossing the road. But from time to time, we see a piece of dead meat on the road. So that was my consciousness. For about 20 minutes. For about 20 minutes. Well, these sages and yogis who were gathered listening to this, they have that consciousness. The body is a piece of dead meat. And the only real living thing is the soul. Therefore, the body that I have and the body that you have, this is simply a covering. Now, it takes some time to be able to actually realize this. And before we realize it, we act as if it's still me. So therefore, I gave up my identity. Okay. When I first became a devotee, my hair was down here. Not advised if you have ginger hair to have hair down here. Not a great display. And then the first thing they did after a few days was to shave my head and give me saffron robes. See, gentlemen, in those days, you didn't have to wait 9 years before you put on saffron. Practically speaking, nobody, absolutely nobody, wore white. Why did nobody wear white? Because it's not a very nice color to wear. It makes you look washed out. Okay, saffron is a great color to wear. So you got saffron on the first day of living in the temple because there was no other color. And the householders wore yellow. And then when you went on Harinam, it looked very bright and cheerful. Instead of looking like an explosion in a bedsheet factory. So I had my saffron robes and I had my shaved head. But my consciousness was busy trying to catch up with this new identity. You know, I was still in my old identity. So after 4 days, I woke up in the morning and I woke up in the morning and I just scratched my head and I felt there was no hair there. It came as a great surprise to me that I had no hair. And they took me on book distribution and I caught sight of myself in a shop window, you know, reflection. And I just looked at this monk looking back at me and I thought, oh my God, what happened? And suddenly I felt very attached. I felt very attached to my hair that had gone, very much, very attached to the clothes that had gone, because my consciousness of myself was having a difficulty catching up. So in this way, our bodily consciousness stays with us for a very long time. So we understand because of hearing that I'm not my body, I'm not this, you know, not this, I'm not a man, I'm not a woman, I'm, you know, this. But at the same time, it takes years and years and years for us to actually be able to say, I'm not this body, and mean it. And that's why we kind of struggle. The whole point of putting on tilak is that you dedicate at least this piece of flesh to, you're designating this as an obstacle. As an obstacle. The body is an obstacle between you understanding yourself to be the soul. So, that's a preliminary. So what's going on here is we have people who are discussing amongst themselves who had been commanded to populate the universe. Not only were they kings and queens, the name for a king is Raja. Raja has, do you think Raja has something to do with Rajaguna? You think Raja has something to do with Rajaguna? Yes, it does. A person in Rajaguna is very creative, powerful, strong-minded, heroic, very passionate. And passion means that they're creating all the time. Creating, fighting, building, politics and diplomacy, having children. There's something, people who are incredibly in the mode of passion. I had a friend once when I was in Africa. And one time we got talking, and I said, I told them I had, you know, three brothers and sisters. I said, how many brothers and sisters do you have? He said, I have 63 brothers and sisters. And I just laughed. I said, come on. I said, no, really. How many brothers and sisters do you have? He said, no, 63. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, my father was a local king of an African tribe, and he had many, many wives. I said, 63 brothers and sisters? He said, no, 63 sisters. I was the only son. I said, wait a minute, you're the only son and you became a brahmachari? He said, yes. He said, I broke my father's heart because he was hoping to have a son who would be like him, who would be the creator of progeny. So very difficult for us to understand this. When the Queen's personal servants came here, they came from Buckingham Palace to Bhaktivedanta Manor, 17 of them. We looked after them for a day. It was the first time in their lives. Do you remember, Shruti? First time in their lives that they'd ever been served by other people. Because, you know, when people come here, devotees, we like to serve. So we were bringing them, you know, soup to the table and, you know, dinner and them sit down and serviettes and grape juice. And they said, oh, we've never been treated like this. You know, we're always serving Her Majesty, but we're never treated like this ourselves. So it just so happened on that day was the day that we chose to go eco-friendly and serve hot soup in biodegradable potato starch bowls. Don't do it. halfway through the meal, the soup bowls started to disintegrate with the heat of the soup, and the soup started to spread all over the table. And there was some embarrassment and nervous giggling. And then everybody started laughing because they realized that we were trying to serve them and it kind of impress them. And at the same time, they just realized that they were servants and that they shouldn't be having any airs and graces about being served. So it resulted in some amusement. Anyway, they told us a story. They said that when the king of Saudi Arabia brought his family to Buckingham Palace, the entire retinue filled, how many? Three jumbo jets. That was the family of the king of Saudi Arabia. So many wives, and each wife had so many children. And it's difficult for us to understand that level of procreation. You know, seated as I am in front of an assembly of men and women who are kind of shutting down their procreative faculties somewhat, it's kind of hard to understand that level of procreativity. So here was a man who had so many wives and so many children that when they went on holiday, they filled three jumbo jets. And of course the servants were laughing because they put the royal flag of Saudi Arabia upside down from Buckingham Palace. Anyway, of course, in that country, women are not allowed to drive. So when they got to Balmoral, what happened was the Queen, Her Majesty, does not agree with this principle of women not being allowed to drive. So she said to the King of Saudi Arabia, "I want to show you Balmoral Estate." And he said, "Yes, I would like that." He'd never ever been driven anywhere by a woman before, so he didn't know what to do because the Queen just pointed to the Land Rover and said, "Well, come on, let's go." someone opened the door, and he said, "But you're driving, I can't." And she slapped the seat. She said, get in, sit down, let's go. And she drove very fast around the estate. Anyway, the servants told us that story. So the point here is we're dealing with people whose potency, procreative potency, even in this world, we find it hard to fathom. These were people who were being asked to populate the universe. These were people who had been asked to populate the universe. Now, in the business of populating the universe, you know, you need some very passionate people. But even being the most passionate person, the most Rajagun-dominated person, that needs stimulation. So even on the heavenly planets, where all these things are going on, the women are very beautiful, and they do the dancing, and they're very skimpily clad, the footbells, the makeup, the beautiful hair. This is all part of the heavenly realm. Because otherwise, what level of procreativity could we expect if the great gods and goddesses were to say, "No, don't. You know, I'm a bit tired at the moment." You know, that would not work. Would not work. So here we have a situation where it's not a man in the forest, it's not a yogi, but it's a goddess, and she is trying to bring the king to his senses by telling him, this is the nature of men and women, this is what happens between men and women. The very bodies of women are designed completely to fit the bodies of men. The bodies of a man is completely designed to fit the body of a woman. The eyes are completely intended to match, because the body is the enemy of the soul. Just like the boil on the body has been achieved after some overindulgence in sweets, and you get boils. So the boil is not as nature intended. It's as your overindulgence has created. So to have a human body, to have this body, this one here, I don't know about yours, but this one here is the result of overindulgence in many previous lifetimes. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, you know, if I really loved Krishna, I wouldn't even be able to have this body. If you really love Krishna, then you wouldn't get another material body. So we have to have a sort of understanding that I'm in this body due to previous activities, and that activity is usually, I want this body. Previous activity, material activity, is based on, I want this body. And at the time of death, I want another body. And at the time of that death, I want another one. And I want another one. Because only by having another material body will I be able to fulfill the desires of the last human body. And the problem there is, and what Urvashi is pointing out, is that those desires will never be fulfilled. No matter how many wives you have, just like our African king, no matter how many wives he had, he was not fulfilled, he was not satisfied. Or the king of Arabia, no matter how many beautiful women you have, you will never be satisfied. Because that's the nature of material interaction. It's like trying to put out fire with ghee. If you pour ghee, clarified butter, onto fire, as we do for our fire yagyas, is the fire satisfied? No, the fire just continues to burn. There's never a point where a fire will say, okay, that's enough wood, enough ghee, I can't handle any more. The fire will always burn more ghee, burn more wood. So the nature of the body is that it will always want to be associated with the body of the opposite sex. That's the difficulty. That's the difficulty. There's never any point of satiation. Satiation only comes when you have something that is of an infinitely greater magnitude of satisfaction. So Urvashi, she's telling the king, she's really laying into him actually. What you're seeing is a tiff between a husband and wife. You're listening in on the conversation that didn't take place in this world, but in another world and in another time. And what she's saying to him is, what you've got to understand, and let me tell you about the nature of women. I'm a woman and I know. So let me tell you what women are like. This is not a man speaking. She said, you know, women are merciless and cunning. And she's over-egging it, as we say, because she really wants the king to break free from his attachment. Usually when you want to free a person from an attachment to something, you overemphasize the problems inherent in that attachment. Otherwise, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we find that the nature of a woman is grace and beauty and kindness and compassion and the ability to nurture children. We find women glorified in different parts of the Bhagavatam. Don't ask me the chapters and verses right now, but it's there. But in this particular conversation, because of his attachment, she has to speak in a particular way that will break his attachment. So she said, you know, you trust me too much. And sometimes a woman has to say that to her husband. A wife has to say that to her husband. She says, the problem is, my dear husband, that you trust me too much. Don't you understand that women as a class are merciless and cunning? The lot of us. Don't think that if you get over your attachment to me and find another woman, that they'll be nicer and kinder. No. They're all merciless and cunning. They can't tolerate even a slight offense. Okay? And for their own pleasure, they can do anything irreligious. And therefore, they don't fear even killing a faithful husband or brother. Now, it may be that when we go to the prisons, as I used to do, I used to make prison visits, and sometimes I would be sitting with a person who was a murderer. And it's mostly men who damage women. Mostly men who kill women. The basic problem in the world is that men love women, and because they love them, they hate them. And because they hate them, they love them. And because they love them, they hate them. And this goes on all the time. I love you, I love you, I love you. And because I love you and I'm not getting satisfaction, because that's the intrinsic nature of the material world, but no one's taught me any philosophy because the school's just taught me trigonometry and calculus. I don't know anything about philosophy because the educational system in Great Britain sucks completely. And all we learned about is how to, how to figure out, if Paul has 3 potatoes and travels 26 miles. And no one ever taught me philosophy. So in the most important thing in my life, which is my relationship with my wife, which is where I'm going to spend 30 to 40, 50 years, nobody ever taught me how to be married and how to stay married, and therefore I'm on the verge of a divorce. Why didn't they ever teach me that in school? Okay? He may not go through these things, but I'm going through those things for you. So he doesn't know anything, and he doesn't know that the very nature of any relationship is, I love you, I love you, I love you. I don't love you. Because now I'm unhappy. Because the very nature of a relationship is not like this. Anybody who thinks that love goes like this has spent too many days watching Walt Disney movies and Beauty and the Beast and the Frog Prince and the Princess and all these things where they all live happily ever after. There is no happily ever after. As Prabhupada said in Edinburgh one time, he said, Srimad Bhagavatam is not a fairy story. He said, do you think I would tell you fairy stories? I was telling my son the difference between an American movie and a Japanese movie. Okay? You know the difference between an American movie and a Japanese movie? Difference between a Hollywood movie, okay, and a Japanese movie, the other end of the world, is at least a Japanese movie is a little philosophical. Okay? The end of an American movie is the kiss. That's how all American movies end. It's the hero, the heroine, and the kiss. Or the riding off into the sunset. Because that's the ultimate conception of human life, is the kiss. That's the symbolic representation of materialistic culture. Japanese movie, boy meets girl, girl meets boy, they struggle. It's not a Bollywood movie. At the end of the movie, the boy dies, the girl dies. Because that's life. That's a Japanese movie. If you haven't watched Japanese movies, and I'm not personally encouraging you to do so, But if you do, you will notice there's no kiss at the end and there's no happy ending. Why? Because it's more based on Eastern philosophical principles that there's ultimately happiness is gained in another world. And that's why it's sometimes difficult for people to understand these verses and the mechanics of what's going on here. So, rather than life going like this, I love you, I love you, I love you more, I love you even more, I love you most, and I love you to perfection, what it goes is, I love you, I love you, and now I'm realizing I made a mistake, and ooh, this is terrible. Why didn't I marry someone else? And gosh, why ever did I marry you? And then he starts thinking, after he's been to class this morning, he said, yep, it's true. What Prabhupada says, women as a class are merciless and cunning. They can't tolerate even a slight offense. And he uses the Bhagavatam to justify his misery that has been brought about by his projection onto the relationship of what he thinks it should be. I love you, I love you, I hate you, I hate you. This marriage is not working. Let's go and see a sannyasi to see if he can tell us about marriage. I go and see my sannyasi, counselor, guru, therapist, and he says, well, this is just the nature of marriage. You know, it's going to be like this for the rest of your life. That's his conviction. He's a sannyasi. He's welcome to it. But we are in that relationship of marriage. We have to push through because it gets better, doesn't it, Shruti? Not that you've ever been down there in the deep, dark well of married life. He's got no time. He's always here. His wife goes to sleep at night, the husband's gone. She wakes up in the morning, he's still gone. Where is he? I don't know. He's changed his phone number. So you're down here. And then you start coming up and you think, okay, actually my husband, my wife, is not that bad after all. Actually, this is rather nice. This is rather nice. This is Krishna consciousness. Happy family life. Okay? Oh my God, it's happening again. This is terrible. And now it's terrible and we are middle-aged. Now it's terrible and we're middle-aged. And it goes up again. Oh, this is very nice. Spending life in Krishna. Now we're both mature and we're we're older. Now we really understand Krishna consciousness. Oh no, now it's happening again. So, this may be 5 years, it may be 5 months, or in some cases it's 5 weeks. Some cases it's 5 weeks. There are many famous cases where the wife has been killed by the husband, or the husband has been killed by the wife. It works both ways. However, in this particular conversation, in this particular situation, at Kurukshetra, right? She's speaking to him at Kurukshetra. So in this particular situation, with this particular woman, to this particular man, and this particular man only, and please don't take this conversation out of context, okay, because it doesn't work if you take things out of context. In this particular situation, she is telling him, for his own good, you have to understand the nature of women. All of us, including me, are like this. We're cunning. We could even kill you. We could even kill you. Very, very dangerous situation. And your attachment to me means that you have forgotten all these things. You've forgotten all these things. Therefore, I'm reminding you. Therefore, I'm reminding you. So please don't take this verse in isolation. This is not a verse that we use as a mallet over the head to bash anyone. The Srimad Bhagavatam verses are not for bashing people. Okay, then you know we know what happens when religions take verses and they bash people with them. What this verse is for you to understand, for you to understand, and to apply to your life. Not at this point in your life, because many of you are unmarried, sitting before me, but you may need these verses at some stage in your life. But please use the verses when you're up here, not when you're down here. Okay, so understand that these verses are meant to be used at particular times because they were spoken at particular times for particular reasons. They're meant as hammers to break attachment. And therefore, Prabhupada said, you have to understand how the Bhagavatam is spoken and how to use the verses. He said, once there was a young boy and he was servant of a great master, and his master one time was walking through the marketplace, and they saw a horse that was choking on a cantaloupe melon, not a watermelon, because that's very big in India. It's an Indian story. So it was a cantaloupe melon, smaller melon, and the horse had swallowed this melon whole, and there was a big bulge in the horse's neck. So the boy didn't know what that bulge was. He thought the horse was diseased or something. So the man said, "Give me a stick." The boy went and got a stick, and he smashed the horse's neck. Now, he was smashing the horse's neck, but he wasn't. He was smashing what was inside the horse's neck. There's another philosophical point to be made here, but it looked as if he was smashing the horse's neck, but he was smashing the cantaloupe melon inside. The melon broke into three pieces, and the horse was then able to choke it out. So the boy went, he thought, "Oh, my master's a very great master." He tried to then take the same thing and apply it in a fresh situation. His master went back to the ashram, and he carried on through the marketplace, and he saw a beggar with a goitre. Goitre means that you get a big bulge either side of your neck due to iodine deficiency. So the beggar was saying, "Hey, Baba, hey, Baba, hey, Baba." You know, that's my impression. Okay. So then he said, "Oh, I know how to cure this. My master taught me how to cure this, you see. So give me a stick." So someone went and said, beating the poor beggar. And of course nothing happened because it was not a melon. It was an iodine deficiency that had caused the thyroid gland to swell up on both sides of the neck. And of course the man then had to be taken to the hospital, the Ramakrishna Mission Hospital. So the point here is, you have to know what the problem is before you use a particular verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam as a big stick to smash the problem. You see? So Urvashi, she's talking to Pururava because he has a particular problem. But for you, that's not the problem. You see, you cannot extrapolate that to a new situation, a fresh situation, and project this verse into every given situation. Because if you do, this verse means that always, for a man, it will always be a woman's fault. You see, he'll project that into the situation. It's always women's fault. But like I said at the beginning, I'm wearing a blue flower garland. You have to think of the Namita Karana, the Somavayi Karana, and the, what's the other one? Upadan Karana. Three causes have caused this flower garland to come into existence. The Mita Karana is the instrumental or efficient cause, the flower garland maker. The blue color is the Somavayi, the inherent color which came from the colored water. And the, what's the other one? Did we say Namita? The flower garland maker. So all these things. So in any given situation, there is a cause. First look at yourself and see, is it you? Could it possibly be me that's projecting something into this situation? You know the famous story of the slightly misogynistic man who was driving the slightly misogynistic red sports car because he was middle-aged and a bit frustrated with life. It happens. He was driving his sports car and he saw a woman coming towards him in another little sports car, and he said, "I think I'm going to show this woman what my car can do." And he sped towards her and she shouted out to him, "Pig! Pig!" The man said, "Cow!" Told you he was misogynist in a red sports car, didn't I? So then he went round the corner and there was a pig in the middle of the road. He had mentally projected his feelings about women onto her statement so that when she said pig, it was an insult rather than a piece of information. You understand? So who was the Namita Karana in the situation? It was him. He was the instrumental cause of the misunderstanding of the situation. Similarly, the man in the ship at midnight, you know that one. The man in the ship at midnight. I tell this story so many times, I can't believe you haven't heard it. Or maybe it's because I only give the Bhagavatam every 9 years. They roll me out for these special verses, as I said. I'll be back tomorrow for another verse, no doubt. So, you know, the man is, you know, he's in a ship, and he sees a light off in the distance. And he says to the first mate, he says, tell him to, you know, flash a light. Tell him to move, otherwise we're on a collision course with that other ship. So then the light message comes back, says, no, I shall not move. You move. He said, flash him a message. He said, this is Admiral Ponsonby Smythe of the HMS Battleship Royal. You move. And then the light flashed back. He said, no, you move. He said, how dare you insult me in this way? He said, you move. I'm a lighthouse. Point is, I'm a ship. Therefore, you're a ship. Okay? I'm a disturbed man. Therefore, you're disturbing me. Okay? I'm a disturbed woman. Therefore, you're disturbing me. Just your very presence here disturbs me. See? The difficult thing is that when we apply this misunderstanding socially, we have, in the history of the world, in the whole history of the world, normally we find it as men mistreating women. If you survey the history of the world, you'll find it, there is a problem. So this problem has to be dealt with. So you can deal with it in different ways. So in Krishna consciousness, we know there's no material solution. No material solution. It has to have a spiritual solution. So that's what we're trying to do. Because only if you premanjana churita bhakti vilochanena santa sadaiva hridayeshu vilokayanti yamsham sundara machintya guna sarupam govindam adipurusham tamam. Only if your eyes have been touched with the ointment of love of God will you have sufficient love to deal with everybody in the world with love. Otherwise, you'll deal with everybody with sort of sorting them into categories. This person's like this, and you'll label everybody, and you'll deal with labels rather than dealing with people with love. So this verse is admonition to a particular person in a place and time, and he was a king, and he had an over-attachment, and so she's telling him, she's finger wagging, she's telling him what he needs to know.